Generally, we don't even think about it. We go about our business in our own little worlds, and it can be very disconcerting to discover that what's actually going on and what we think is going on are two entirely different things. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, All in Your Head. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Stay tuned. This Snap Judgment podcast is supported by MailChimp. More than 5 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters, and MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com.
Okay, so you submit a paper to a scientific journal detailing a breakthrough advance that leapfrogs everything you ever thought of modern medicine. Do they give you a medal? Maybe stick your picture in the front of their publication? They do not. They don't. First, they ask you, where did your PhD come from? And when you say, well, I haven't got any PhD, they send your paper back to you unread. They don't even read it. And you know, I can't stand coffee. The Coca-Cola made of noxious chemicals and these energy drinks. Who would put that stuff in their body? Still, I wake up so tired. Well, wake up might be a bit of an exaggeration because I never go to sleep, but you know what I'm saying. Day after day, awake, always awake, enough to make some people crazy, but not me, of course, I'm fine. I just figure there's gotta be something I can drink, something to make the spinning go away. You don't need a PhD to make spinning go away. I read books, the internet, so I mix stuff up, mix it in the blender to see if it'll make the voices settle down. I know I didn't mention the voices, because you'll think it's important. It is not. And that's why I didn't say it. But I mix the stuff up, you know, in my smoothies. I make smoothies, blueberry smoothies, banana smoothies, passion fruit mango smoothies. Lots of smoothies out there, you know. I sip the new one, the one I just mixed up. And it tastes like something I haven't had since I was 8 years old. This smoothie, it tastes like a nap. Like drinking the longest, most luxurious Saturday afternoon peanut butter chocolate chip cookie with bananas afternoon nap I had back before my brain got better. Well, I remember. I remember and I think, the world has got to know about this for the benefit of all before the PhDs steal it. So I go down to the university. I tell them I need to speak with the dean again. They say, no, please go home. But I wait outside for several hours, and I know that I have to try something different because people, they don't understand. So when the dean comes out, I remember Mother's angry dog. She'd rub his belly. Rub it to make him feel better. So I go to the dean and I ask him not to run away. And I start to rub the dean's belly to make him feel better. And I tell him about the smoothie I made. And I brought him some so he could taste it himself. And I pat the dean on the head. And I tell the dean that he's a very good boy, that he's a very good boy. But the dean doesn't feel better. He gets angry. And I understand he's angry. And I know he'll feel better if he just tastes the smoothie. I try to pour some of it in his mouth, but he moves his head back and forth. He sputters. He doesn't drink the liquid I'm trying to funnel into him. It's very frustrating. And the officers try to tase me. Of course, that doesn't work. And they hit me with their sticks until they get tired. And they tell me that I'm not allowed to ever come near the university again. And I know.
I know if I had a PhD, I could come to the university, and maybe too, if I was better at the speaking stuff. I see the people, they're talking to each other. One speaks and the other speaks, and they take turns. It's the timing. I see it's in the timing, and I try to run up to the women and tell them about my credit that's due me. I move my face in front of their face, and I shout to make sure they understand. And more people come to hit me with their sticks until they, too, get tired. The talking, it just doesn't work, so I think maybe I can make a smoothie to help with the timing. So I say things and people don't run away. I think maybe just a little something. So it wasn't that I meant to create another person. No, just a little something for the timing. I mix and I mix and I stir and I mix and put it all in a blender with some frozen mangoes and bananas and I drink it right down. And sure, it feels strange, like someone else is inside me, riding me. Some other fella, and this guy, he doesn't much like smoothie. He runs straight to the store. I run straight to the store, grab some whiskey, and drink the whole bottle right there in the Safeway, aisle 9. Quick as you please. I grab another bottle for the road and start racing down the street. Then we're in one of those nightclub establishments. He spies two women talking to each other, then sidles up and starts speaking to them both. He asks him,
"What's your interest, dog? Who you be with? I got some things to make you smile. What number should I dial? You gonna be here for a while? I'm gonna call my crew. You can call your crew. We can rendezvous and do the doodle you to do."
His timing. The timing's unbelievable. One of them mentioned she has a hot tub, and then we're in the hot tub finishing off his whiskey and the laughing. And then it's all me, without that other guy. And I have to answer the woman asking questions. I tell her I'm not familiar with the concept of skinny dipping, and I've got to leave at once to continue my work. At home, I mix up some more smoothie, and that other guy comes back, and he's angry. And he's shouting about, "Where are the girls? What am I doing in this stupid apartment?" And all of this, he starts knocking things over and he wants to punch me like everyone else does, but he is I and I am him. And I feel him thinking thoughts I never thought before. He calls the university, which I know is a very bad idea, but people answer and they laugh. And he says he'll email them, and he does. Then he has an appointment. Some researchers have already examined my work and are blown away by the implications. Could I please come in to discuss my findings? We go to the office. I'm waiting for their security team, but instead, a very attractive fat woman in a pantsuit comes out smiling. She looks down at her notes, looks up at me and says, "Dr. Jekyll, I presume." I take a little sip of smoothie. I carry it in a flask now. Then he smiles at her.
"Wrong on two counts,"
he says.
"I'm not a doctor because I don't have a PhD.
And he breathes with the timing, always with the timing, this guy. Looks her up and down.
"Jekyll, that's my middle name. Instead, please call me Mr. Mr. Hyde."
Well, today, from PRX and NPR, Snap Judgment proudly presents All in Your Head. Amazing stories from real people discovering that what they see, what everyone else sees, are not the same thing. My name is Glenn Washington. Buckle up, because this is Snap Judgment.
Now, I was one of those kids for whom the world I invented in my own mind was so much more real to me than anything that teachers, my parents, or even my classmates could bring to bear. It was a land that I could get lost in. And we're going to kick off today's episode with the story. While it sounds a lot worse than it turns out. Parents, I would give a warning as this story does allude to a sensitive subject, but don't worry over much. It's all right. Snap judgment.
I'm going to sound terrible. This is making me into such a terrible human being.
So that's my friend Monica. And what she's talking about is this story she told me a while back. About this time as a kid when she told this one really, really damning lie.
I don't know. I hate to think of myself as like a terrible little liar. But I must have been. You know, I gotta, I guess, face the facts. When I was 8 years old, this was in Brooklyn, New York, in a yeshiva, one day the school class got called to go to an auditorium presentation of some sort. It's this big auditorium, massive. It's like 300 kids. The principal comes in and says, okay, everyone get quiet. We have a very important presentation. And I'm just like psyched because I'm out of class and I hated the Hebrew classes. So we're missing as much Hebrew time as possible. And before I even know it, the curtains like part on this big stage and out comes this big yellow furry and feathery costume. It's Big Bird, of course, followed by the Cookie Monster, followed by Bert and Ernie. I was dying. You have to understand how much I love Sesame Street. See, growing up in South Brooklyn with Russian parents, the only thing that my parents knew they could clearly understand was good for us was Sesame Street. So that's all I watched. So to have them all of a sudden on stage, in front of me, in the room, I was all ears. But now I see that they're like talking about something that involves touching. They talk about how like if that's okay, and they reenact something that I'm very confused, but I'm watching. I'm really attentive, and I'm like, okay, Sesame Street, they're sitting on each other's laps right now. They're touching each other, and they're telling me something's okay and something's not. And at the end of the presentation, they're kind of like, hey, everyone, well, thank you very much for your attention. You've been an excellent audience, and if anyone has anything to add to this, feel free to share with us and stay behind, essentially, while everybody else goes back to class. I'm like, man, I'm not going back to class. I'm a smart 8-year-old. And then I precisely remember them saying, and if anybody wants to, you know, talk to Bert and Ernie about this, feel free to raise your hand. And I just shot my hand up straight up in the air. I'm like, I do. Chance to talk to Bert and Ernie. I am staying back. The teacher looks at me, Mora Yuta, is like, Miriam Sender, are you okay not to go back to class? You have something to share? I'm like, yes, I have something to share. And then, you know, it's pretty silent. And there's only like one person up at the front. And this teacher is approaching me with like someone else in the clipboard in her hand and comes up to me and says, okay, Monica, this must be very sensitive. And it's really courageous of you to want to stay back and talk to someone about it. I'm listening to her. I'm like looking at her in her eyes. And she's like, of all the things that were discussed today on stage, what happened to you? And I just said all of it.
Now, just to be clear, Monica's parents did not abuse her as a child. This is just a complete and utter fabrication. But it does get her exactly what she wants. A few minutes later, lo and behold, she is ushered into a small room, and there she meets Bert and Ernie.
You know, I'm like, wow, Bert and Ernie. Like, oh my God, I could touch their costumes. This is amazing. So they started asking me questions, but I figured it out pretty easily. All I had to do was just say yes. So, does your mom or dad ever hit you? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, do they strike you with a fist? Yes. Like, do they spank you? Yes. Do they use tools? Yes. Anything they could have asked me, I just did this. They could have just been like, is the house on fire at home? I would have just said yes to anything at this point. I was just like looking at this big smiling face with googly eyes. And I was just like, awesome. And then a teacher comes in, followed by two other teachers. And all three of them were saying, they're like, you have a younger sibling in the school. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, well, does she experience the same things you do? And I'm like, well, I don't know. They're like, do you think she wants to talk to Bert and Ernie? And I'm like, yes, she does. They bring back Donna, my younger little sister. She's in first grade. She has no idea at this point. So she comes in, and of course, they start asking her questions, and she's getting scared. She's like in that kind of like crying mode. And now all the administrators come up to my sister and like, oh no, maybe this is too much for her. We should take her out of the room, because they're thinking she's sobbing because she's like an abused child. And now I'm starting to realize, oh my God, what am I causing? Like the snowball is just growing. And all of a sudden, I see through like the little square window of like the classroom, I see my mom's in the hallway. And I'm like, wait, why is mom here? And then I hear my dad's voice. Like, you can't mistake his Russian accent. And I'm like, wait, why is my dad here? And next behind them, I see the police are escorting them. I'm like, wait, officers? Why are the officers here? And then it clicks. I see it in my parents' eyes that they're like really worried and really confused. And Donna's like, oh, mom and papa. And she runs to them. But of course, they're like, no, 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 no. You can't run to them and hug them. And I only find out later all the repercussions of this, about the fact that they're like, a social worker is going to have to check in with them now, look up on me. I'm going to have to like see the school nurse, make sure there's no like bruises on me, all this kind of stuff. But next thing I remember is that we're in the car and we're going home. And we're sitting in the car and it's like dead silent. And I could only imagine what my parents must be thinking about, because they couldn't do anything. Like, they couldn't scream. I think they themselves felt like for a second scared of my power, like over them. So it's like they couldn't punish me.
Well, yes and no, but Monica, tell me what happened. You said that after this incident that you had to see the school psychologist.
Did I?
Yes.
Did I tell you about this?
Yes.
Here's the thing. I can't recall what I told you and what I don't. And now I'm stuck. I can't even back out.
Now you're stuck.
I wonder if maybe my mom will just completely deny this story ever happened.
It's
maybe.
Possible. It's possible.
She won't. She remembers it.
Hello?
Oh, hi, mom.
Yes. Hi, Monichka.
Hi, mommy.
Hi, mamala.
This is Monica's mom, Irene.
How are you?
Good. Good, honey.
We called her to help us set the record straight. She said, yes, it did happen. Monica did accuse her and her husband of physical abuse. But her adult recollection of events has one slight difference.
Nobody really bought into it that she was abused at home.
Why is that?
Well, because Monica, prior to this incident, there's so many other incidents where she would put kids together on the playground and she would tell them stories. And they were always children around her, listening to her. So I think everybody knew she made it up.
And she finally took it too far with this Bert and Ernie thing, with the Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah, Bert
thing.
And Ernie was too far, because I don't think she realized that we're going to be called in, and I think she got scared a little bit.
Did this scare her straight?
No, it scared her, I don't know, for an hour, I don't know. Not really.
Yeah, you see, I remember everything very differently.
Well, you can't get your facts straight
at all. I can't even tell the same story a few times, because just like I think this story happened, I can't see the facts anymore. All I see is the memory and the realization of what a great story that makes. And if there was a better way, or if there was a more interesting way to tell something that essentially had the same point, I would just do it that way. Even if it really wasn't true, why not make the whole process just a little bit more interesting? Why not just fatten it up a little bit with some more like zest and spices?
So, Irene, in light of that, do you think Monica has improved?
Improved in her storytelling? Well, that's what makes Monica Monica. No, Monica, she'll tell you stories. You'll never be bored.
Big thanks to Monica and her moms. We appreciate it. That piece comes to us from KCRW's Unfictional. Every week, they find some of the weirdest and most beautiful stories from around the world. Check them out on iTunes or kcrw.com. That story was produced by Joe Rosenberg, with sound design by Renzo Goriel.
Now then, when Snap Judgment returns, we're going to reveal a very special talent. We're going to uncover a mystery, and we're going to follow the dictates of a goddess. For real, when Snap Judgment, the It's All In Your Head episode continues, stay tuned. Making trips to the post office is becoming a thing of the past. You just don't need to do it anymore, thanks to Stamps.com. You already know that going to the post office is inconvenient. Driving there, finding parking, waiting in line. What you probably didn't know is you're paying more for postage than you have to. Stamps.com is the better way. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, right from your computer and printer. Then just hand it to the mailman. With Stamps.com, you'll get special postage discounts you can't even get at the post office. On first class, priority mail, international, and more. Never go to the post office again. And right now, there's a special offer for listeners of the Snap Judgment podcast. A no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in SNAP. That's Stamps.com. Enter SNAP and happy mailing. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the All In Your Head episode. Now, there's this thing that some people do more than others. It's called, is it me? You go to a place and everyone's acting a little bit off. There's a clown balancing three infants on spinning plates, and no one says a word about it. And you're like, is it me? Or has this place got an odd childcare policy? Snap Judgment's Davey Kim wonders if it's him all the time.
It's eighth grade, and I arrive at school. I've been dreading this day all year long, because today is the day that each class has its spelling bee. My best friend John shares my pain. Because, well, let me put it this way. I'm not trying to say that we're cool or anything, but we're both part of the Skinny Jeans Skaters crew. John and I even just started a screamo emo band called A Dream Deferred. Yep, that's us. But secretly, we're also really good spellers. And it's not cool to be a good speller. But you know what? We can't resist a good competition, so we're gonna do this. John heads to his class, and I go to mine. We have our spelling bee, and guess what? We come out on top. And we're going to regionals. After school, we're high-fiving each other, and it just so happened that we were the only Asian kids in our grade, so we joked between ourselves that our Asian power helped us win. A few weeks later, John and I carpooled to the regional level spelling bee. And we're pretty confident that this year, one of us is gonna take home the first place trophy. We scope out the competition. In front of us, there are four older judges. They look grave and serious. I notice that John and I are the only Asian kids here. Again. Which doesn't really matter. Whatever.
Oh, welcome, everyone.
The spelling bee begins.
Pochi Small.
Meister Singer.
Nirvana.
P-O. And students are getting eliminated left and right until there's only a handful of us left.
L-E. Susceptible.
Some of the kids who got cut are waiting in the back with their parents, crying. The judges look at the word sheet, and then they look at each other. Then they take a look at John and start chuckling to themselves. One of the judges then says,
"Don't worry, son. You'll get this word."
The entire room is confused, especially John.
Oriental. Your word is oriental.
The judges start laughing to themselves some more, and soon the rest of the room starts snickering.
What are the odds?
But I'm not. You know what? I get it. How can this Asian kid mess up the word Oriental? But still, this is embarrassing for John. John's about to start spelling. He's nervous from all the attention. His knees are shaking, and he's fidgeting with his hands. He begins.
Oriental. O. R. E.
And he stops. He messed up, and he knows it. He just turns around and heads over to the back of the room. Man, I'm furious now, but the only way to get back at everyone is to win this thing. Soon, it's my turn again. I wonder what word I'll get. Asiatic? Confucius? I walk up to the front of the room. I'm a little nervous.
Reconteur. Your word is reconteur.
I have no clue what this word means, but I've seen it around, so I'm pretty sure I know how to spell it. I rehearse it in my head, raconteur, R-A-C-O-N-T. I got it. I ask for the word in a sentence, I ask for a definition just to make sure. I'm ready to spell it out. But right before I do, I look back and see John. He's not crying like some of the other kids, but you know, he just looks really sad. I look at the judges right in the eye and begin spelling my word.
Raconteur. R. A. C. I. S. T. Raconteur.
I don't turn around. The judges, the parents, and all the students have their eyes locked on me. I just stand there facing the judges for 4 very uncomfortable seconds. And no one's laughing now. I leave the stage. I go over to my best friend, and we walk out of the spelling bee. Medalist, but victorious.
All right, Snappers, in case you're wondering, a raconteur is someone who tells great stories. Thank you, Davey, for telling us that tale of sweet R-E-V-E-E-N-G. R-E-V-E-N-G-E. Check out our website, snapjudgment.org, for other great raconteurs. That story is produced by Davey Kim, with sound design by Davey Kim. Okay, so it would not be right for us to proceed with the All in Your Head episode without bringing to the mic a character who has been in all of our heads here at Snap since the very first show. He moves in and out of our lives like a specter and then materializes in our studio right in front of the microphone. Just the other day, he came through with a story about living life as a very delicate balance. Joshua Walters, the microphone is yours.
At the end of March, I traveled to upstate New York for a gathering of international artists. One of the assignments for the retreat was to bring a special object that reflected something about our craft and was a symbol of ourselves as artists. I brought a paper boat hat. About 4 inches wide and 2 inches tall, the paper boat hat was a story and a drawing written on a piece of paper and folded into a hat that looked like a boat. I had been carrying it in my backpack for years and to this day didn't know what it said inside, because the story written on the paper was in French. In the opening ceremony, the artists gathered around and shared their stories, connected with their objects. When it was my turn, I shared the story of my object, and the room went silent. A few years passed. I was traveling through Canada on a speaking tour as a mental health educator. I had gigs lined up every week, professional conferences, universities, high schools. And a few months prior, in a decision of reckless abandon, I had decided to drop the bipolar medication that I had been on for 10 years. My partner at the time was convinced that medication gives you offspring with a higher chance of being disabled. She worked with autistic kids, so she saw it every day. And so when we were on a mission to get me drug-free, which was heavily laced with denial of the fact that I had been living with a mental illness for 10 years, we dropped the pills, and I started a manic race to Infinitron, where I cut ties with family, friends, her, and personal connections to pursue a life on the road. I thought that touring would last forever. Through the speaking work, I started to improvise my scripted talks, going on for hours at a time, keeping students entertained with a bizarre blend of performance and spoken word revolution. After a couple weeks of shows in Canada, I was totally out of the realm of reality and completely out of my mind. I ended up in the mental hospital in Montreal. I felt like I had spent a good deal of my adolescence in institutions. This was my first time back in 10 years, and I was manic as ever. The hospital was located in the French section of Montreal, and for about 8 days I was in the emergency room of the psychiatric hospital. As I met the others who I shared a hospital room with, some who reminded me of uncles, some much younger who reminded me of superheroes, I had a series of rituals that got me through being around so many mad ones in a cramped ER where there were about 20 beds, one bathroom, one shower, and a couple of nurses making sure nothing went terribly horribly wrong. I would get up early and walk the one hallway. Then I would dress in a new smock. The hospital clothes had buttons and lace. I would go over to the corner where the windows were. You could see the outside. I covered my head with a towel and held the corners of the stone window ledge and moved my torso back and forth in a rocking motion. I was davening like a Hasidic Jew, prayer time, where your body swings back and forth in a sort of non-musical bob. I would see people outside, walking by, and I would focus on each one, shut my eyes, and try as hard as I could to imagine I was out there free. There was this boy, he could have been 18, right on the age limit. Dark skin, bald head. He moved like a young Professor Xavier, and I could see there was a lot of potential in his mental capacity. There were times when it felt like he could read minds. I approached him at lunch. He was sleeping through most of the days and missing meals. I got him some fruits, and we read magazines, and we talked in his broken English. He was a regular teenager at heart, pointing out ads of scantily clad girls and hard alcohol. We didn't have a great deal in common, especially when it came to smoking weed and riding dirt bikes. But we were here together, and that was enough of a bond to hang out and be like brothers. The next thing I would do is I would ask for a piece of paper, one small sharpened pencil, and I would begin to write. I wrote things that I didn't want anyone else to see. I wrote things that I wanted everyone to see. The boy with the bald head stumbled on some of my writings one day. He found a section about the person who killed Michael Jackson and how that was his own doctor, and thus, doctors could not be trusted. The doctor I was assigned to see in the ER was scared of me. Another doctor saw me. I was taking a vow of silence. He asked me if my psychological condition was just acting. What a question to be asked in such a situation. The boy mentioned my writings. It made him a little more anti-doctor himself. I could see how the line about Michael Jackson stuck in his brain. I was sorry he saw it. The last thing someone needs to do in a mental institution is deny help. During our time together, he would write, and I would write, and we would talk, and eat oranges, and eat bananas, and eat yogurt, the closest thing we could get to ice cream. We spent one day writing, and he wrote out a couple of lines in his story and scribbled a drawing on the page. And then he folded the paper in an origami boat that looked like a hat and gave it to me. On my last day, I packed up my belongings, clothes in storage that I wasn't allowed to wear anyway. I put the paper boat hat on his bed. "This is your story," I thought. "You keep it. It'll mean something to you someday." They came for me with a wheelchair, and instead of sitting down, I put my stuff on the seat. "I'll walk," I said to the nurse. We were headed towards the door when the boy ran after me. "You forgot something," he said. He handed me the paper boat hat and then put it on my head. "For your trip," he said. I never knew what it said on the inside. I never even unfolded it until years later, sitting in a circle of artists in upstate New York. There was time for one last story, so I shared. I unfolded the hat. It had a few lines of French with a scribbled drawing. I was sitting next to a guy who was from France. He helped me translate it to the crowd. "I am not feeling good," it said. "For me, life is not easy. My brother tells me to eat garbage, as if it was me who sent it." The note didn't make perfect sense, but the fact that we got to translate it was enough for me. At the end of the four-day retreat, we put our special objects in brown paper bags and exchanged them in a kind of secret Santa to see what we could get anonymously. An Israeli musician who played the violin got the paper boat hat to take home. I unwrapped a different paper bag. I got soap.
Joshua Walters is a writer, an actor, and a musician. You can learn more about Joshua at thejoshuawalters.com. He's given a TED Talk on his mental health experience. We'll have a link to that as well at stepjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Mark Ristich with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Now then, when Snap Judgment, the all-in-your-head episode, continues, the cerebral part is over. The mind games, all finished up. This next piece, you're going to feel this one. Stay right where you are. Don't go anywhere. Snap Judgment.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the All in Your Head episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and I am thrilled because we've saved a very special treat for the Snappers. As much as we love putting on the show from our secret underground hidden fortress, even better than that is taking Snap on the road. Our next story comes from a recent blowout storytelling extravaganza. Go ahead, take the best seat in the house for Snap Judgment, live in Los Angeles. Sensitive listeners should note
that this next story does contain some graphic imagery.
Now, next up on the Snap Judgment stage, this lady was with us from very near the beginning. We have chronicled tales in her life for some time. She was a go-to person. She was my go-to person. But then she disappeared. She left me all alone with no Joyce Lee stories to tell. And now she's back to explain herself. Tell us where she was. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce Snap Judgment's Joyce Lee.
I once read of a god named La Kesabe, who created women out of a wrinkle on the sole of her divine foot. And this is supposedly why women are so intuitive, because we are made from the skin of the soul, in other words, the soul, which feels everything. I think the women in my family must have been pulled from the callus on La Kesabe's foot. There is no such thing as sick or tired to the women in my family. There is only dead or dying. Other than that, we feel okay. By the age of 12, I knew how to do everything in a house short of paying rent and bills. But I never knew how I felt until I was dying. I've been sick since the first day I became a woman. My menstrual cycle was supposed to last for 7 days. Instead, I bled for 6 months straight. The doctors never said anything about death, so according to my family, I was alive and well. With time, I learned to ignore my body and deal with it only when it became a bother. A little over a year ago, I went on a poetry tour throughout Europe. And I ended up in a very conservative suburb on the outskirts of Istanbul, Turkey, called Beykent. Beykent was very different from me. I fell in love with it immediately. The olive-skinned people, the modern dress women flawlessly made up, some wearing scarves, some fully covered in all black, exposing nothing except the eyes, the dark-haired men, the blue-eyed Muslims, the ancient architecture. I fell in love with it. I just had to stay. Everywhere I went, everyone wanted to know everything about me. I thought it was wonderful. Until I started looking for an apartment. Well, you know, the neighbors gossiped about my lover, Mert, who was obviously not my husband, and all the noise that me and Mert made laughing and dancing and doing other things at night. But it was great. I lived happily in Beykent before my body began to bother me. I became exhausted because the bleeding would not stop. And I was hoping that Mert wouldn't notice, but for a couple weeks there had been some heavy making out with no follow through. And so he had to ask what was up. I'm bleeding. Oh my goodness, where? Oh, tamam, but last week I was bleeding. Okay, hospital, we go now. I told Mert everything, that I was okay. That I dealt with it my entire life, that it would go away on its own. A week later, I'm laying in my bed pale-faced, my legs elevated. Mert's doing all of my housework and spoon-feeding me while I'm still waiting for my body to get over it. Me and Mert argued about me going to the hospital every day, but I was okay. No, I couldn't walk without my bones burning and without my heart beating like I just escaped a bear's grip, but I was okay. My body was just tripping. One day, Mert came in to feed me a meal and he saw my face and I guess he just flipped. Jenim, there is death in your face. We are going to the hospital now. If you don't want to go, fight me. And I know you're strong and we can stay here. I swear. Poor fella, I cursed and cursed and cursed him out. But I was too weak. I couldn't even ball my fist. By the time I got to the hospital, I was delirious and completely out of blood. They had to stick needles in my feet to draw blood, and I don't even remember how many tries it took them. Mert held my hand while I was being wheeled, and he spoke to me so gently. Surgery now, Jenna. Surgery, just a little bit. It stops the bleeding. And just a few cuts, 15 minutes. I can't go with you because we didn't marry. But I'm outside the door. Tamam? I was laid on a surgery table. And it wasn't until the first cut in my uterus that I realized that I hadn't been given any anesthesia. By the third cut, I let out a scream that scared the entire room into taking two steps back. Mert pushed through the doors, walking fastly, speaking fastly. No medicine, Jenna, no medicine, because you have no blood to hold it. Just a few more. You know, every time they stick the needle in, your vein pops. A few more cuts, just a few, Tamam. He begged them to stay and was escorted out. I laid there exhausted from my scream, but I had managed to lock my knees together, and I refused to unlock them, no matter how much the doctors begged. Just one more cut, just one more. I knew I could not endure another. Let me die. I told them, let me die right here. They began talking amongst themselves, and I just laid there thinking. But mostly for the first time in my life, I laid there feeling, I mean really feeling everything. In my soul, my body felt like a huge shell holding a small, determined, noisy pebble. I felt weak. I felt hollow. Every bone burned and ached like it was celebrating finally getting my attention for the first time, and I felt it all. I felt it all. And I thought, so this is what death feels like. Like life out of control. I began to cry when a huge Turkish man barged into the room, grabbed my lifeless left arm, and began hitting and hitting and hitting. And the minute he saw the wink of a vein, he shoved the needle in, and I felt all types of cookie, candy, caramel, beauty, goodness course throughout my entire body. And I looked at him. What is this? And I swear, he smiled, and in perfect English, he said, good night. After the surgery, the doctor told me that I would feel the same exact pain in my uterus that I felt on the operating table once a month during each of my menstrual cycles. I returned home with feeling monthly pain as my new normal. But everyone, they all wanted me to admit that I was still the old normal. My family said, well, you know, God spared you. You're okay. Which is another way of asking me to continue to live my life like callus on the sole of La Casabe's foot, to be functional and unfeeling, to live a life just above death. But I tell everybody I am not okay. And I crouch in pain and I yell, even though it makes people uncomfortable when I feel like it. And guess what? I even have the audacity to pick up the phone and tell my friends at this stage, no, when I feel like it. Because one thing that operating table in Turkey has taught me is that it's just fine for me to feel anything. And I feel everything.
Joyce Lee.
Joyce Lee, do not get in her way, people. Joyce told that story, courtesy of our host and friends down there in L.A., KPCC. Thanks so much for having Snap Judgment down. The music you heard was written by Mr. Alex Mandel and performed live by
Alex Mandel and the Snap Judgment players Tim Frick and David Brandt. Congratulate yourself. You've done it again. But if you've missed even a second of Snap Goodness, you've got the antidote right here. Full podcasts, episodes, movies, stuff available for you right now at snapjudgment.org. Friend us in the Facebook, Snap Judgment. Tweet us on the Twitter, Snap Judgment. The Snap was produced by the least duplicitous team in all of radio. What you see is what you get, especially from the uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Because these beats won't make themselves, Pat Macedi Miller. Julia DeWitt has connections. Anna Sussman eats for two. Renzo Gorio fights the power. Joe Rosenberg is possessed with the strength of two Joe Rosenbergs. Nancy Lopez leaves a trail of crumbs in the forest. David Kim is magically delicious. Leon Muramoto owns his own bowling shoes. Jasmine Aguilera presses all the elevator buttons, and Will Urbina knows that monster movies are really allegories for the truth. If Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, how many peppers would Peter Piper pick? The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has no idea. Please stop asking, but much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, sells seashells on the seashore. PRX.org. WBEZ is the place of WBEZ when you be the WBEZ in. Know what I'm saying? And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, if you knew exactly how much wood a woodchuck could chuck, if a woodchuck could chuck wood, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.